Talk. Gig Talk.
What's new at WGXC? Well, there are a lot less live musical performances on the air, as there are a lot fewer live musical performances anywhere these days. But WGXC has a new show on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. called Gig Talk. Matt Motel and Kevin Shea take your calls about gigs, musical performances, future and past. Call in at 518-622-2598. Talk to Matt Motel and Kevin Shea on Gig Talk, Thursday nights at 8 p.m. on WGXC. It's 518-622-2598. Call in to Gig Talk, Thursday at 8, on the radio at 90.7 FM.
You're listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Art Omai, a sculpture and architecture park and international residency center in Ghent, New York. Open daily from dusk until dawn. Art Omai presents the work of contemporary artists and architects across 120 acres of field and forest. Information at artomai.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tunstall Studio Publishing of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. This is Kevin Factor, and you're listening to Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, a little family reunion. My cousin Jason, whose father and my father were brothers, was on last month, and he talked a little bit about how Missouri and Florida were handling the pandemic, because he lives out there, grew up out there. And my cousin Mark, who's a second cousin, his grandmother and my grandmother were sisters, but we're a lot closer than that because his grandmother and my grandmother were inseparable. They were very, very, very close. We're going to be sharing some family stories. So some of them are funny, some of them are surprising, some are heartbreaking, some are heartwarming. Learned a lot about what we thought happened that didn't maybe happen, and I hope you enjoy it. Mark is going to start off by sharing a rather damning story about my father and how my grandmother was sort of treated in the family and her role in the family.
The way that your father perceived your grandmother to basically be at their beck and call all the time.
Oh my God, yes.
And he made the point by just basically, he liked this drink called Postal.
Oh God, I remember that.
And what he used to do is just basically ask your grandmother in a nice way, but this time he just went, Postum! And he snapped his fingers, and your grandmother went right to the cupboard and grabbed some of this stuff as if it was just like embedded in her brain what to do. Is the most, I'll never forget, it was the most hilarious thing I've
ever seen. Yeah.
Yes. It was one of those things you never forget.
No.
I will never forget any of those people, your grandparents, your parents. I had a blast. They were fun people to be around, and it was a lot of yelling, but it still was fun. I mean, I had the pleasure of having a, you know, a Danish-Italian dad and a Austrian-Hungarian mother. So, you know, on holiday time, I would literally go from, like, you know, Seder to Juanus, you know, on one day to Easter dinner the next day. And there was very little difference except the accents were slightly different. But we were always not eating enough. We were always too skinny.
Oh, yeah.
And there was always food on my plate when I wasn't looking that I had no idea where it came from. So
you guys lived sort of daily with you and Beth Ann, with my grandparents, right? Your grandma, who you call Mima,
yes.
Right?
Yes. She lived in the same building.
They lived on the same floor.
Yeah, it was a while though that your grandparents lived at Ocean Parkway, and they moved to our neighborhood and right. did live on the same floor, on the same street as us. So we did get to see them quite a bit. So basically any time that our grandmother wasn't around, we always knew where she was because right. she was obviously over at, I think she lived in 5D and your mm-hmm. grandparents lived in 5J, which was basically the polar opposite side of the floor, but it was still very easy to find somebody in the family at that time.
Yeah, no, I still remember it was 40 Tehama Street.
That is exactly right. And I lived on 68, which was literally two houses away.
Yeah, no, I remember.
The only thing that separated us was a temple, Jewish temple.
Oh, really? I didn't even notice that.
Oh, yes. Like right between the building and the apartment, my house and the apartment building was a Jewish temple that was very busy at certain times of the year with lots of prayer services. And
did you guys go to that temple?
We did not. No, actually, I kind of dabbled in both religions. Mm-hmm. My sister was better at sticking with one, but she found her school with all that pretty early on at another place. And I think actually for maybe a year, she might have gone to after school yeshiva.
Really?
There. Yes. She would remember better than I would, but I wasn't that turned on by the Jewish religion due to the fact that I'd been to a bar mitzvah and saw that, the women were actually seated in another room. And that kind of was like, maybe not.
It wasn't that long ago. Like that your sister, I went to go visit your sister and she was like, telling me how my grandmother and your grandmother would have Passover Seders together. Mm-hmm. I never even knew that until last year. Like, I just thought they were just like not religious at all. But apparently, like, our grandma kind of was, you know?
Yeah, I would say religious for the times that it was on the calendar. I mean, I never really, you know, sat at evening prayers with my grandmother or your family. I mean, we never really did any of that more, really worked the religion stuff. But when it came to a holiday, no, they were right there. They actually uh-huh. did a pretty good job with that. So yeah, Passover Seders and remembering, Hanukkah and, doing Rosh Hashanah, she fasted. So yeah,
really?
I mean, for that. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I remember that. I remember marking that day on my calendar going, do not go over to Mima's and ask for food this day. And, yes.
They were
very special, very, very giving and very special people.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was surprised that my grandma and your, or Jason's grandma went our Aunt Dot did the Passover Seder. Because, like, my grandfather was pretty virulently anti-religion, you know?
Yeah, he was anti a lot of things, you know, conveniently.
Yeah, yeah.
My father, actually, when I talked to him, remembers, Dave, your grandfather, very fondly. He really was kind of a contradiction in the things that he said and a lot of things that they did. You know, it was kind of a, very much about the workers of the world unite, but at the same time, you know, not in my neighborhood. So it's a little bit everything.
Well, I don't know if it was not necessarily not in my neighborhood, but there was a certain level of responsibility he felt for just for taking care of his family.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And he liked going out for Chinese food. He liked to eat out.
Yes, he did.
And
Wohop, if I recall the name Wohop.
Wohop. He was interested, labor rights and civil rights for African Americans. And he marched for all that. He marched for
women's rights and even later gay rights. He'll go march for women's rights, but he wasn't going to cook dinner.
You know, that wasn't his thing.
You know, and but well, I will say the only thing he knew how to make was onions and eggs.
Oh. Yep, I remember that.
He knew how to make, you know, and he was so proud of that. And when a poor grandmother went blind and couldn't yes. cook anymore, she ate a lot of onions and eggs.
But yeah, at the same time, I mean, I can't remember two more dedicated to each other people in my life that I've ever met. I mean, that's the one thing I think of everything else that I remember about them that really sticks with me. In my memories of them, they were really, really two of the more dedicated people in terms of each other I'd ever seen and still have ever seen in my life. So I got to give them credit for that.
Really?
So, yeah. I really
do. I don't know. Jason, what is your recollection? I mean, yeah, they were just married forever.
They were, but I mean, they had obviously their disagreements, but at the end of the day, there was no doubt that they were, you know, I mean, I can't say Aunt Mal without saying Uncle Dave.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, onions and eggs. they go together. So that was maybe it was a naive recollection.
Yeah.
Maybe it was something that wasn't based completely in how things were.
I mean,
you know, back then, I know everybody got married because it was the thing. You needed to.
And you stayed married and you just yes. go. You're like, all right, well, you know, it's you. And they just were, my son I named after our grandfather, David, and mm-hmm. which is sort of the only Jewish tradition I have continued. And actually, funny enough, I just had a Passover Seder because my girlfriend's Jewish and it's interesting. But I insist on calling him David, and I insist that everybody calls him David, and we have since he was a little kid, because as much as I loved my grandparents, Dave is is like this is like it's Dave.
Yeah.
Shut up, Mal. I mean, that's what I remember then.
Don't ever remember him telling her to shut up.
Shut up,
I don't remember
shut
that.
Shut up, Mal. Oh, no.
I mean, he used to interrupt her all the time. That I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember him actually being that cruel to her. Maybe I missed it.
Oh,
Maybe it
wasn't. It was just, it wasn't even, it's funny. You say cruelty, and it was just like, it was just casual. I mean, they were just.
Yes.
Their bickering was just, that's was their default. Like as far as yes. that I could see, you know.
Yes.
I remember, I think this was on Ocean Parkway, and I don't know if you were there, Jason, but it was their 50th wedding anniversary. And they were in that big, beautiful dining table, and my grandfather says a toast. He goes, here's to 50 years. It feels like 150 years.
Oh.
And I was like,
wow,
that's just how married people do things. You know, that was it.
You know, I was probably there given you all the totally, times I was around,
yeah, yeah.
But I don't remember this stuff. I mean, I just remember that they were like Lego pieces. I always saw one with the other,
huh.
You know, huh. You know, obviously up until, you know, the illnesses, but that's to me,
yeah, yeah.
That was the thing that I just struck me about them from a young age. So
yeah.
Like I said, maybe I just blocked it out because I had it so much in my life, that cacophony of,
yeah.
of sound, but but really it was the thing that I think I'll take away from them the most was that they were just, they were almost like, I couldn't think of one without the other.
Yeah. Well,
simply
the nicest thing. I'm sorry, Jason. Poor Jason's just not getting a word in here.
I'm sorry, Jason.
But, all right, I'm enjoying the recap. But I'd like good. To hear about your memories.
The nicest, one of the nicest things I ever heard, grandma say about grandpa was the building was going co-op, right?
Oh, 40 Tehama?
40 Tehama was going co-op.
Yes. And, oh, yes.
And they had the option, right? And they were not planning on staying, and they weren't going to buy. But there was a buyout option, and they would have gotten a good chunk of change for their apartment. And that was a consideration. You know, these people lived through the Depression. I mean, they were both born in the early 1900s. You know, they knew what it was to struggle, and money, you know, was important, and security. And the building was going co-op, and they could have gotten a real nice buyout. But my grandfather said, we're not going to leave Dottie. And they stayed there. And I think your grandma, Mima was ill at the time. And
probably.
So that sort of window closed. And then I think like within a month, your grandma died.
She passed in, I'm going to say early 1988. She'd been sick for a while, the emphysema, but I think that was the year. And I believe it was the year before, or maybe 18 months before, where they started that discussion maybe about the building. I can't remember exactly. I just remember that was a major consideration of your grandparents.
And she simultaneously, it pained her that they didn't get the money, but she was also super proud that Grandpa had made that decision, or that they had made that decision together.
Next segment in the family reunion, Jason tries to get a word in edgewise and tell his version of how he experienced Brooklyn and our grandparents at that time growing up, and I interrupt with a story about poo.
So, Jason, what are your recollections then? Or do you have a different take on some of the stuff that Mark and I are yammering about?
I agree with Mark on the dedication side completely. You know, they were completely dedicated to each other all the way till the very end. Although I did have a very interesting discussion with Grandma one day. Grandpa had passed, and Grandma, you know, was essentially totally blind at that point. And we were sitting in Fort Lauderdale in the condominium. And we were just sitting there, and she goes, "I don't know." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, what do you don't know?" And she goes, "I don't know. I don't know if I married the right guy." And I just kind of paused, and I said, "Well, it's kind of late to be reevaluating that. And had you not, none of us would have been here."
Yeah.
So, and she kind of paused, and she goes, "Yeah, you know." And it kind of stuck in, but you know, she was obviously second guessing it at that point, even, you know, after the game. So
they were going to get divorced.
You're about to enlighten me on something I wasn't aware of about this divorce thing.
Before you continue, was it talk or was it actually action?
They were going to get divorced on several occasions, like, you know, because they just really just didn't get along all that well. She said, she's like, "Yeah, we were going to get divorced, but then we're like, eh." <You know? laughs> Yeah. So it's like, it's going to be such a bother. I mean, we're already done, you know? I mean, basically that's what the thing was. But, she had a lot. I mean, I love that woman. Nobody adored her grandchildren more than her. I mean, she was like, and I don't know that, and that was an important and damaging part of my life, I think. because I think I've told you this story where I'm just going down a rabbit hole, but she was concerned that my Shiksa mother, I told you this one already, but then, she was concerned that my Shiksa mother wasn't feeding me well. So she wanted to see the product of this, right? And I know, Bethann, I know you and Mark, and I think your folks were still married at the time, Aunt Helene, Uncle Frank. You guys were, it was out in Dix Hill. It was in Dix Hill. So it couldn't have been more than 4 or 5. And it might have even been my birthday party or something. And everybody was out there. And I deposited a remarkable specimen, and I did not flush.
I knew that
grandma would be over the moon because this was like, this was a work of art and I made this, right? So I go into the kitchen where everybody is, and I'm like, and I just proudly, I was like, grandma, come look. And my mother, like, the look of horror on her face, like, oh my God, this woman already doesn't like me. And now she's going to think I'm like a terrible mother because my son is asking her to take a look at his crack, you know? And
that's great.
And my grandma, I remember grandma, because she takes my hand and she kind of looks at my mom and goes, it's okay. I asked him. And my mom was like, oh, I could tell that she had like, oh my God, what is this family? And I remember I walked in and we looked at it and she was like, beautiful. And gave me a kiss. That's and great. We flushed it together. And I was just like, oh yeah. Completely destabilized my ability to self-assess. Right.
This is Kevin Factor, and you're listening to Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, family reunion. And I'm sharing stories with my cousins Mark and Jason. Next up, Mark and Jason discover something about their grandparents.
They were two of the more, you know, inseparable people I'd ever known in my life in terms of never seeing one without the other. And, of course, you know, that was just my perception as a young person. But obviously it was the type of thing when you're at the age that they were at, everything was loud and argumentative and oftentimes, you know, it was just who they were. I mean, obviously I didn't know them when they were like, you know, 30 and you know that, but you know, it's what I grew up thinking about them as people, that one wasn't seen without the other. I mean, when your grandfather died, it was the weirdest thing to see her once or twice and not see your grandfather. To me, it was jarring to me.
But again, they also had a life that you saw that we didn't see, Mark. Like that they liked going out for concerts, you know, and they liked dancing, you know, that they were good dancers together. That was really kind of a cool thing to, you know, to know or learn about them later in life. Because like when the children were around, you know, It was their job to, you know, they just were doting. There's not strong enough of a word, you know, to describe that. But I know that I knew that grandma and me and Aunt Dottie were thick as thieves, and that was always a cool relationship.
Yes, you know? It was, and they would always, I mean, to a fault, bring up that, you know, like my grandmother would always talk about, you know, everybody in her family, how they were doing, you know, if they weren't together, you know, she would give us the update. And, you know, she was very proud of being part of the family. She'd never leave you guys out. She'd never, you know, it's like your grandmother would never leave us out of something, of an event.
No.
Of you know, whatever it was. I mean, part of it was convenient because we're in the neighborhood, but you know, it was always, you know, mi casa su casa. So
yeah,
you know,
no, like as Jason said earlier about you know, grandma sort of wondering maybe she didn't make such a good choice marrying grandpa, though I'm sure we're all grateful that she did, but one of the last times I do remember seeing her, she was, you know, she was sad. She was depressed. Obviously she'd lost a husband and a son, you know?
Yeah.
And she said, we never should have moved to Florida. She said, I never thought life would end up like this. I always imagined that I'd live in Brooklyn and that my sons and my family and my sister and their families, that we'd all live on the same block and we would all sort of be together. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we ever moved to Florida. We never should have done that. And that literally just almost made me cry, you know, that like this old woman, like she had so like, but, you know, she gave, you know, I think she gave us and everybody more than she ever imagined she could have or did.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a good summation of her. And, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, she was like my second grandmother.
Yeah. You know. So what do you make of that? All of our parents did not marry Jews. And then got divorced.
All right. Well, who do you want to talk first?
Jason. I want to hear what Jason's got to say.
All right,
about
go ahead, Jason.
Well, so first off, my dad did marry a Jew first.
Yeah, that was just a starter marriage.
That's what he said. He said that was just a joke.
His
explanation of that was, I needed a job, and they only hired people who were married, and I needed to be married to a Jew, so I got married. And
is that actually,
you know,
the story?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
serious. Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So that's you know, more. It was only like 2 years, I think, that they were married. It was an incredibly short time that they were married. And, you know, grandma and grandpa absolutely despised this woman.
Yeah, they totally did. And, like, they still talked about her. Not that talk about it, but they're just like, I forget what her name was, but they would go, da-da, and they both go, oi.
Yeah.
They'd start talking in Yiddish, I think, when they started talking about her. No, they really didn't want any of us to know about that. I mean, I'd heard, you know, but I – really, when there was talk about life before, you know, your mother, Jason, and it became almost like a code, you know, that they needed to kind of get through. So we wouldn't have to be exposed to it. You know, it's weird.
No, it's like a Shonda for the Goy.
Yes. So yeah. Exactly.
My mom was a recovering Catholic at the time, and she was, you know, fairly agnostic in her beliefs at that point in her life. And, you know, they were both in the similar garment industry together. My mom was a fashion designer. She was a designer and, you know, they got married and she got pregnant with me. And, you know, back in the day, it was a different kind of day. So as soon as they found out she was pregnant with me, they let her go. And,
really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, which wasn't, you know, necessarily that uncommon back then, you know, in those kind of.
No, it was very common, but. It certainly times have changed.
Yeah. And that's, for sure. And so, I mean, that's what, the long and the short, I don't know. I to be honest with you, I had never really given it any thought that they had all married outside of the Jewish faith. But, you know, interestingly enough, you know, my exposure to temple was actually grandpa taking me there. I don't know if you
really,
yeah. Yeah, you know, that summer I spent in Brooklyn when mom and dad were getting divorced was kind of amazing in ways when I look back on all the things that he did. Because, you know, we went to Broadway, you know, we went and saw the Pirates of Penzance and got to experience that. And we went to the federal courthouses and we got to, you know, watch these armored car cases and we would go back and, you know, follow up and watch them. And we went to Chinatown, you know, and that's where I remember Wohop the most from. And we went, grandpa insisted on taking me to Harlem, you know, and walk, you know, getting off the subway in Harlem and walking down the streets of Harlem so that we could see how that experience and that livelihood was. And, you know, just the different things that he exposed me to while I was there were, it was pretty amazing, actually. You know, it wasn't the happiest time of my life because what was going on with my parents, but it was definitely a cultural experience because I never would have gotten any of that otherwise. So, going to Wall Street, you know, and spending the day on Wall Street, you know, watching all of how that process worked and then getting up in the morning and reading the Wall Street Journal and trying to figure out stocks and the financials, you know, that has benefited me to this day. So, You know, just those.
Yeah, he explained the difference between stocks and bonds to me. And,
yeah, for sure. For sure. So anyway, I'll let one of
Which
you go.
Which is interesting for a communist, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But there was no better tour guide of New York City, like when I think about it now. Because he'd been there forever, right?
Mm. Yeah.
You think about it. When he was born, the Brooklyn Bridge was like 20 years old.
Wow.
Mm. Right?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Probably.
He saw all of these things going up, right? And he would say, I think, I don't know if it was Harlem or Brooklyn or wherever, but there was a row of brownstones. And they were shabby. This was New York in the 70s, you know, in the early 80s. And he said, upper middle class people used to live in these buildings, right? This used to be a rich neighborhood. And then he said, and it's going to be a rich neighborhood again. And he was spot on.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Did you go to Sheepshead Bay too?
I don't remember if it was Sheepshead Bay. We went to, is that where Lundy's Brothers was? And that, because I'm remembering going to different seafood restaurants that were on a bay, but I don't know if it was Sheepshead Bay.
Well, if you ate clams, you probably went to Sheepshead Bay. And I agree with you about the tour guides. In fact, for theater and for opera and for that area around Lincoln Center and Broadway, my grandmother knew everything. She would talk to me about the, because she had just a subscription to the New York City Opera, and she'd point out the Chagall works at the Met, and she'd talk about all the famous opera singers that she had seen. And I just remember she would talk about Caruso specifically.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not sure if she told me that she'd actually seen him live or not, but she was very enamored with his voice specifically. And she did have some recordings that were Enrico Caruso recordings. And I used to bring up my little record player. It was actually a Pluto Disney record player. It had a bone as a needle. And she found some records that were not, that, first of all, I couldn't play the ones that she originally had because they were 78s. And I could only play 33s and 45s. And we finally found some recordings, RCA recordings that were 33s. The fidelity was awful, but the voice, she was right. I mean, she could pick out the best of the best when it came to that. So that was my memory.
I wonder why he's not more famous. Yeah.
Seriously. But no, she knew her stuff about that. She used to always course me into coming with her to certain productions. Obviously I was more in line with Gilbert and Sullivan stuff, the lighter stuff, but she got me into a couple of things that were pretty heavy.
Next up, we talk a little bit of politics. Try to get along because we're family. No single person is just one thing.
Sure.
You know, like no person is like even just a murderer, right? They might also be a father or a son or a brother or a good community member and stuff. Like you all these different people, like murderer is not like a great thing to be, but no one person is just one thing. And same as with a communities and same with countries. And the thing is we have so much, we have just eliminated so much compassion at this point. Because it doesn't serve the interests of the political parties or even the media to a large extent that we have trained a generation of people to only see people as one thing, right? And then you don't have to think anymore, right? You can turn your brain off. You don't have to think anymore. And that's dangerous. And that's why we've gotten this, you know, not why, but one of the reasons we have this sort of tribal situation. We're just like, the craziness out there is,
and the tribalness is going to keep us from getting out of this in a quick way. And
unless,
Hey,
unless we're attacked by Mexico,
but
or
then
something.
We'll unite around that.
United we stand. United we stand, and divided we fall. You know, and I agree with you guys. I think that that's part of it. You know, Mark, you were saying, you know, you believe what you want to believe, and I think that that's true too. And I think that as long as our mass media is divided politically and pandering to a very specific segment on each side, and we're not getting truthful reporting, we're getting slanted reporting on both sides. You know, if we just had a truthful medium that we could actually believe, because, you know, Kev, you're right. You know, watching TV news now, it's all garbage. You know, it's and
you try to
look through the internet to try to find factual news stories. You know, that's why so much of what I do when I'm trying to figure out what the truth of something is, I try to go to the data sources. I try to look at the data. Data doesn't have an opinion. But it also doesn't cover the complete story, like you were saying, Mark, because things are deep,
yes.
Right? Things are multifaceted. Yes. A murderer might be a father. Maybe that person was beaten their whole life that created a mental condition that they don't. You know, there's just too much to.
Yes.
To fathom.
But I believe
when you're going to tell a story, tell the story.
Yes.
You know, tell the accurate story. Don't slant it so far one way or another that you are only presenting what you want somebody to buy into and get riled up about, and then therefore they stay on your page and click on your ads.
But we also have to understand,
but real quick,
I'm a history teacher also, and I'm always teaching my kids that you have to go look for the primary sources. You have to speak to people. You have to find out what's really going on. If you want to be I was in communication school. You want to be a journalist, you have to talk to the people that are there, that were there. You can't go on hearsay. You can't go on third or fourth person, you know, versions of what actually happened. You need to go to the source. And even if you have one or two people that are distrustful about what is happening, eventually, if you speak to enough people, you're going to get an aggregate of the truth. You're going to get some aggregate of what is exactly going on in a place or in an environment where you're being told something is happening. And something very different is the fact. Right now, Richmond, Virginia, if you turn on Fox News, is burning. Okay? We have people roaming the streets. We have people knocking on doors in the suburbs. We have Antifa. We have, you know, QAnon. We have all this going on. Nobody's safe. They're coming to get you. It's not true. But if you want to believe that, you know where to go so that you are – you know, you're feeling better about yourself by believing that. And that's the problem part of this is. Okay?
Yeah. It reinforces your opinion.
Yes, absolutely. You don't want to talk to me as a resident of Richmond about how beautiful the Lee Monument is now that people are actually starting to go there and check it out because it represents something different to people now. You just want to know those criminals are being locked up for defacing something. That's the difference. If you want to actually go and see what's going on, you have to go. You have to visit. You have to speak to people. You've got to talk about their feelings. You've got to understand their point of view. If you have no desire to do that, you will never, ever find the truth. Period.
That's right. But isn't that what those reporters should be doing in these cases and reporting that back to us?
That doesn't sell versus TV, that obviously we are talking about entertainment. And if we can cut through the crap and say these things are entertainment, they are not meant to inform us. We've got people that are running B-roll of a fire going on 2 years ago in the Ukraine as showing proof that Portland is on fire. That's not okay. That's not okay. Okay.
Right.
If you can find evidence that something is going on that is a danger to people and you need to warn them that it is life and death, then you have a right as a news organization. You can lose your FCC license for doing this. You're supposed to be working in the public's best interest. That is why I have an FCC license for broadcast. You needed to pledge that what you were doing was in the best interest of your audience. We got people that are running the news organization here in Richmond that are basically posting fake banners that are saying that Antifa is going to show up and basically set fire to the west end of Richmond. Is that a news station that is working in the best interest of its community? I don't think so.
Of course not. Of course not.
Well, yeah. I don't know. If
And I'm sorry to start warning about it. I apologize. Yeah.
No. Hey, you know what? You're passionate about it because you're educated on it and you know the way it's supposed to be. And why the FCC isn't doing anything about it, I don't
exactly.
know.
Exactly. And I don't want people to misrepresent what is going on that is actually quite beautiful and quite, you know, healing in my city, and not something that is becoming more divisive and more violent. It is actually something that people are coming together and talking about under, you know, they're actually having church services under the Lee Monument. They have a basketball hoop under the Lee Monument. They have people actually bringing their kids and talking about the people that have a little memorial set up for them under the monument. You may completely disagree with whatever movements you want, okay? But here's the thing. This is not what they are selling you on TV, and that's right. What needs to be told.
Yeah.
So. In this segment of Foraging Ahead, Family Reunion, I try and change the subject. Let's talk about food. So, Jason, I remember talking to you before, at some point. You guys are part of a CSA.
Okay. We were
farmers market.
We were part of a CSA. Yeah. Unfortunately, that CSA shut down, but we do get a lot of our stuff from farmers markets, organic sources. We try to buy a lot of our meats from places that are organic, holistically raised. Yes.
That's great.
Why is that a decision that you guys have made consciously?
Well, it's a lot of it is because my wife got educated on it. You know, she's a scientist and she's also a biologist, and she started researching nutrition because of her own personal health issues while she was pregnant with my first son. And when she started learning about all of the pesticides, the growth hormones and other things that were put into food, we, you know, with that education became a decision to make a change. And we decided that we needed to try to kind of break from what everybody else was doing with the McDonald's and the, you know, the fast food of America and try to, you know, eat healthy and take care of ourselves. So, and our family.
That's something I could completely get behind. Totally.
Personal health is the number one reason why you should do it. I think, you know, you could go into the whole discussion of big agriculture and the greed of the companies that, you know, Monsanto and some of those other ones that produce the pesticides and that, you know, patent the seeds and competitive practices. You could go down all those roads you want. And that rabbit hole is deep. We would be here for a very long time with that too. But at the end of the day.
Yes. Well, I will agree with you on one thing. Corporate greed and the problem of the fact that a lot of these big name corporations, their CEOs and CFOs, they're still making the same amount of money they used to before the pandemic started. And that's a big problem. They should be more inclined to take care of the people that are under them, take care of of their workforce, and they're not doing that. So I totally agree with that. Go ahead.
No. But, you know, it's one of those – I agree with you too. I think that these companies don't – I think they care about the bottom line more than anything else, because that's exactly where their bonus comes from. And I will disclaim that by saying, you know, I understand why corporations are concerned with shareholder value. I understand how that works, and I appreciate that fact. But I think there becomes a line that you cross when you start implementing some of the practices that are anti-competitive and are just downright unhealthy for people. And so as Bridget started studying about our health personally, she started studying about health nationally. And, you know, our nation's in a health crisis just because a lot of it's due to the nutrition that we don't have. Our nutritional level, our standard American diet is the standard American diet is a sad diet. You know, that acronym is appropriate. You know, we just aren't a healthy people. For COVID is obesity. And, you know, we have a largely obese, we are losing access to our restaurants. I think that's what we're terrified of.
That's awful.
So you're listening to WGXE. And I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead, Family Reunion Edition,
Next, my cousin Jason talks about his mission in prisons in the state of Missouri.
And we absolutely care about our neighbors. You know, we serve our community through a number of different things. I'm the Cub Master for our local Cub Scout pack because I firmly believe it's important to pour into our youth. You know, we both serve in our church and in different ministries. I go into prison and do prison ministries. I don't know if you knew that or not. But so I've done that. I'm in youth ministry, and I also do some addiction recovery ministry. So there's a lot. I mean, you know, we try to give back to the community in a number of ways. And yeah, so at the end of the day, you know, we're human beings and we're not assholes. You know, we're actually good people.
The fact you go into prisons, let me say that I think that's very, very, you know, that's important actually in this crisis too. I mean, we are forgetting people that are most vulnerable, and we obviously have prison populations that some of them are actually being able to, you know, get out early, or if they're not as violent offenders, be released on, you know, or go serve their sentences at home. But how do you deal with the despair? I mean, do you feel like what you do in the prisons, Jason, helps these inmates have hope, is what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay. So a great, great, great question. So first of all, you guys know I'm a Christian, and I'm very, very strong, yes, in my belief. And yes, obviously, if I'm doing ministry work out there, that says that. But so what do people need in prison? They need hope. They need to, yes, have some understanding. You know, there, when you have people who are in a situation, and if you haven't been in a prisons, you would just be shocked. I mean, we all have this vision of a prison in our head as this terrible, awful place. It's worse. Yes. It's worse. It's worse than you can imagine, you know, and now with COVID going on, it's even worse. You know, there's contamination wings. And I mean, when somebody tests, you know, you can go in and get a COVID test, or I can, or we cannot. When they decide they're going to COVID test, it could be 2 a.m. in the morning. They flip on the lights, they walk in, they shove something up your nose, and you're tested. You know, you don't have those freedoms to say yes, no, or anything else. You know, you don't have rights, period. You know, you do, you eat when they say, you go to the bathroom when they say, you stand up and get in a line when they say, you count off when they say. I mean, you're told everything to do throughout the day. I mean, you're micromanaged, mm-hmm, to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. And when you see that, when you see, you know, grown men and women in that kind of situation, there's a huge despair there. So being able to share the gospel with them and let them know that there is still hope, that there is a God that loves them and cares about them, because a lot of these people may never have had anybody that loved them and cared about them. They may not understand that. You know, when we in Christianity, a lot of time we talk about God the Father. But when they picture their father may have been some abusive drunk that beat the hell out of them and sexually abused them. And so you don't know what you're dealing with in there. And let me tell you, you know, going into a prison and doing ministry, it's interesting because, you walk in and obviously steel doors, guards everywhere on the way in, but then they shut the door to the chapel and basically it's you and a couple other people from your church. There's no guards in there. There's no cameras in there. There's no any kind of monitoring. And it's, you know, just you in there with 30, 40, 50 inmates. And, you know, the first time you do that, it's intimidating.
I can imagine.
It's a different kind of experience but once you start talking to them, once you start, you know, hearing from these people and you've been back a few times and they recognize you and know you and start to open up a little bit. And these are all just people that are hurt, you know, mm-hmm, these are people that are hurt. They're hurting people and they need something. And, you know, the gospel is something for them is to give them hope and inspiration, you know, that their life may be screwed up right now. And maybe it's screwed up permanently. They may never be getting out, you know, that's common. You know, these people are locked up forever in some cases. To be able to give them some hope and to give them some encouragement and direction that they may never have had otherwise is helpful in that respect. And that's what we're there for. We're not there to, when you go in, there are very strict rules. You know, you are, when you go in, you are part of the ministry team in corrections, there are advocates for people when they get out to go help them, you know, get places to live and get jobs and stuff. But you are completely separate, and you have to know that you're not allowed to be one of those. You can't be an advocate and working in corrections. So you, you've got to separate that and know that there's going to be these other people taking care of it, because it's easy to get personally drawn into some of these situations, and they want you to. A lot of people want you to get that connection and be drawn into that. You can't allow that to happen. You can have a personal connection with them while you're there, but boom, when you're out of there, that has to stop, because you cross those lines of becoming an advocate. And so there's all these rules in place and a lot of stuff that goes on, but it's really an interesting thing. It's fascinating. Obviously, it's not happening right now.
I think if enough people actually went to prison and understood why there is such this discrepancy between who's in and who's not, maybe a few more people would understand why people are out in the streets getting pissed off. That's all.
Yeah. Has that made you rethink how we do prison in this country at all, Jason?
Oh, absolutely. Because I'll tell you, you know, before that, I was ignorant to the whole situation of how things operated, how it really works in there. And I was very much of the, hey, these people have done a crime, they need to be punished. That's what the system's for. And that is a component of the system, but only one component of it. Believe me, they're getting punished. Just living there is being punished. But that is not helping them to reform. That is not helping them to build a new life when they get out, if they get out. That is not helping them to improve their chances of getting out. And so education is a huge one. Absolutely. You know, getting a college education, getting a GED is a huge deal for a lot of these guys and girls. You know, getting any kind of formal education that they may not have had up till that point. Getting counseling, trying to understand why they did the things they did. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, these are all people, man. You know, these are all people. They've just they've made bad choices. Yeah. And but why did they make those choices?
Or their lawyers sucked.
They made well, there you go. You know, but here's the thing. Even about the ones whose lawyers have great lawyers, they're going to probably do it again and again and again, most likely, until they get caught, especially, you know, predatory type people. But if you dig in and you actually talk to some of these people, If you sit down with somebody who's a juvenile sex offender, who would be the pariah of our society, and start asking them questions, talking to them, you know, what brought you to that point? Well, you know, when I was 8 years old, my neighbor started molesting me, and for the next 5 years, I was their sexual object.
Yeah.
And I never told anybody about it. I kept it all to myself. And then what was my interest when I got older? Well, by no means am I excusing what they've done to somebody else, because it's not an excuse, but it gives you a context, you know, and you can start to understand, okay, this person was victimized themselves. They were just like their victim. Mm-hmm. And if we don't get this person some counseling, they're just going to go do this again. You can lock them up for 5 years and turn them out on the streets. They still have those same desires, and they don't know how to cope with them or handle them.
Mm-hmm. That's also the insidious nature of intergenerational poverty. It's like you say, they made bad choices. Yeah. But what choices did they know that they actually had?
Sure.
When you're a kid, you see what is available to you based on, you know, your home, your community, school, right? Which is why school is so important and why school funding is so important, that kids don't see other ways of being, right? They don't know that that's an option.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
If you've never seen an airplane, you know, you're not going to know that it's possible to fly in one, right?
You don't know what you don't know. But, you know, I'm talking about even kids that are in white middle class kids who had parents that stayed together. Yeah. You know, they've had issues in their life where they have these things. Yeah. And instead of being able to open up to their parents, go get some counseling, deal with it, They bottled it up and repressed it and didn't know how to deal with it. And it came out in other forms. Let me say this. It's different in every single case with those people. You know, it comes down to, once again, you can't just generalize and go, oh, they're all bad people. They all just need to be punished.
And let me just clarify, by those people, you mean people who are in prison?
Yeah, those people in prison. Yeah. When I say those people, I refer to prisoners.
No, I know. I just need to clarify. I just need to clarify for the radio audience, Jason.
Gotcha. it is a span, like you said, of you know, different generations, different genders, different ethnic backgrounds, different economic backgrounds. So those people are the prisoners. Those are my people when I go in there to preach. You know, those are the people I'm trying to reach out to and trying to give them some hope and give them some understanding that they are loved. And hopefully when they get out, one of the support mechanisms that they can use is a good church, because there are good programs from those churches. There are not many programs out there when you're out there, when you're released, to really help you reintegrate well.
Yeah. Well, I would make the argument, why aren't more people doing what you're doing before they even have the opportunity to do something so terrible that they get to prison? You know, why aren't we doing more at the outset instead of trying to make, you know, we talk a lot about, and you said it yourself, it's like where, you know, you are in a situation in your life because you have just, you're just born under a bad sign. You just didn't hit the lottery. That may not be enough for you to survive just what the world throws at you. And that's the problem that a lot of people are out there trying to fix. And this is why, you know, what we have to do as a country is be proactive, not reactive. We have to be proactive, and we have to think outside our community and think outside of the places that are our comfort zone and find those people where they're at, like you said, before, you know, when they're younger, when they are elementary school age, middle school age, because that's where the money needs to go. All these commercials about how terrible it's going to be if the police are defunded. Let me tell you something. Education's been defunded for years. Okay? We are where a lot of that money needs to go, because if we want to keep people out of prison, we need to start when they are more susceptible to the ideas of why prison exists. And that's when they are younger, that's when they are vulnerable, and that's where we are not doing our job as a country and basically as a socioeconomic, you know, system. And that's the problem. And that's why people don't understand when they say, well, when we talk about defunding the police, oh God, I can't, you know, how can people even say that? People aren't saying that we're not going to have a police department. People are saying that we're going to put more money into social programs. We're going to give teachers that work in high risk schools a raise. We're going to make sure that special education teachers are taken care of and that they're able to do their job without there being so much governmental interference. These are the things we need, and these are the things that we're not getting as a country.
Yeah. I don't think most people who are actively, you know, criminal element, and there's a psychological element to a lot of it, obviously, but I don't think that the fear of prison affects most of them. And I don't even think the fear of going back to prison affects a lot of them. I think it comes down to, like you said, if you're stepping in on the beginning with education, that's huge. I think that being aware of the signs when you see kids, when you interact with them, you know, if I'm working in Cub Scouts or if I'm working in youth ministry, I try to keep my eyes wide open to signs that this kid may be suffering from something. Mm-hmm. And if you can intervene at that point, maybe, just maybe, that kid can get some counseling.
Yes.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, that's,
but, you know,
advocacy, very important. And we don't have enough advocates for the kids that need it the most.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
So thanks for listening in to our family reunion. I'm going to leave you with one question I had to ask my cousin Jason, and he answered it beautifully. If Mark and I aren't Christian, are we going to hell?
Well,
I'm sitting there bated breath for the answer.
I'm just assuming Mark isn't.
That fortunately is not up for me to decide. So that's a pay grade higher than mine. So
good dodge.
That's good.
All right, guys. Be good.
It's been a blast. I love you guys.
I love you too. Good.